This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
All right, hello, my name's Dan. Welcome to another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We've got a World Space Week special this week. Everyone all over the globe, they've been celebrating everything amazing and mind-blowing that's in the universe. So we've got a space expert on the show in a little bit to answer your questions. Also, we're learning about what happens when planets go on the run in this week's Dangerous Dan. And we'll talk about how World War II affected the way space around the UK still feels. Very quickly, I want to say hello to Isaac B, to Tristan, to Youssef and Kenz, who are in Dubai as well. Thanks for listening, and thank you so much for sending in all your amazing science questions to the show through the iTunes podcast store. We've got questions for everything in there, from leaves to human cells and how many we've got in our bodies to the very formation of the world. Now, I promise, guys, I am doing my best to get on some genius science experts to come on the show and to answer those questions for you in the next few weeks. If you want to get involved, if you've got a science question that you really want answered by a proper, smart, genius expert, you need to go through me first. The best way to do that is to leave your question as a review on the iTunes podcast store. So open that up, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly. When you've got that, leave us a review, drop us your name, give us 5 stars if you fancy. Then there's a little comment box in that. You can write your science question and I'll see it and I'll get it answered for you in the next few weeks. So we're celebrating World Space Week on the show. So I thought we'd get like a proper space expert to come on and to answer some of your questions. And we've got Keir Boxall. He's worked with NASA. Keir, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. And we've got a load of questions in. They've been sent in to us by this app called Pop Jam. The first one is by Tinkerbell123. The names get better. Who asks, what is a meteorite made out of?
Hi, Tinkerbell. A meteorite is made from mainly rock and iron.
Yeah. And how does it form? How does it get put together? So there's this rock, there's this iron. Is it just floating around the galaxy? How does it end up as a meteorite?
So it's left over from how the solar system was formed. So you get dust particles basically coalesce together in space, forming larger and larger particles, and then eventually they form a spinning disk, and that's how a solar system is formed. And then they start to the gravity crushes them and they get really, really hot and they start to melt together, and then they bash into each other and they break up, and there's this big cycle of things spinning around and bashing into each other and breaking up. And then there's the asteroid belt is left as a vestige of that process in our solar system, and that, so they all basically come from the asteroid belt.
So why do they form, though? What is it going on between these sparse items that draws them towards each other?
It's gravity, yeah. So every particle has mass, and so if you have mass, then you create a gravitational field, even though it's tiny. So the forces that we're used to dealing with, so your phone and that water bottle, the attraction between those that there is, the gravitational attraction between them is minute compared to the gravitational pull of the Earth, which is huge, which is very, very massive. So
if there was nothing, so that we've got this water bottle in front of me, what's stopping it from being sucked into my hand and never being let go?
Because the Earth is much, much bigger than you, and the Earth is pulling it down to the ground.
So if there was no gravity from the Earth, just for say, everything would be stuck to each other all the time.
If you and the bottle were in space, then you would be slowly drifting towards each other. Yeah, but the force, it's an inverse relationship. So the further away from another massive object you are, the exponentially smaller the force is that pulls them together. So, but that force will always be there; it doesn't disappear.
This question is from Talking Machine over on Pop Jam, who asks, how big is space?
That's a great question. So it depends how you're defining space. So if you define space as, if you're thinking of space as the universe, which is what we look at when it's nighttime, then we call that the observable universe. So we can only see the light, basically, that's coming from other things in the universe. And that's about, it's a little bit over 90 billion light years across.
So does that mean it takes 90 billion years for light to travel from the furthest point that we can see to our eyes?
Well, it's a diameter, you know, so it's kind of 45 billion years to the edge of space. But yeah, if you were on one side of space, of the universe, and you were looking at the other side of the universe, it would take, yeah, more than 90 billion years for the light to get to your eyes.
And if you take into account everything, not just the discoverable universe that we can see, but everything that exists out there, do we have any idea how big that might be?
So they think that... So space, so the Big Bang occurred, you know, space rushed out first, and then protons, so then light rushed out afterwards along that space-time continuum. And so what we can see as the edge of the universe is, you know, that 90-odd billion light-year diameter. And then beyond that, space is a quadrillion times larger, which is one with 24 zeros after it. It's very, very big.
You said that after the Big Bang, space rushed out first.
Yeah.
What does that mean? So just nothingness, more nothingness rushed out first?
Yeah, basically, yeah. So the reason... So I wondered whether you might ask me... So the universe is only 13.8 billion years old, and nothing travels faster than light.
Only, yeah.
Yeah, so... Or that we know of yet, and... So if it's over 90 billion years old and it's only 13.8 billion years old and 90 billion light years across, doesn't that mean that light has travelled faster? Because those two numbers, you know, it should only be able to be 26 billion light years across, if you see what I mean.
I do. Well, this is a question from Elodie 12 Dancer, who asks, what would happen if we didn't have space? The answer may be nothing.
Yeah, so that's a difficult question to answer. So if we're talking about if we didn't have the universe, then, I mean, we basically can't exist without space and without the universe because we exist in it. So if it wasn't there, we wouldn't be here either. But if you're talking about the universe, then things would just get gradually colder and nighttime would be quite boring because we wouldn't be able to see all those stars.
Staying up there just for a second, this is from Sarah and Matthew, who are in Abu Dhabi, who asks, is there an end to the universe? What do we know is at the end of the universe?
Well, so we know that there's this wave of... So you can think of it, the Big Bang, a little bit like, you know, dropping a droplet in a lake, you know, or in a puddle. So there's this ripple that's going out from that first Big Bang. And
is it slowing down the ripple?
It's speeding up, actually. So the universe is expanding and getting further apart.
Wow.
So there's a force that was created in the Big Bang that's pushing everything outwards. What was the question?
Is there an end to the universe?
Ah, yes. Is there an end? So there's an end to the observable universe. So that's that 90 billion, mm-hmm. And then that quadrillion times larger bit is, you know, so yes, there's an end to space as we know it, but we have no idea what's beyond it, and which is a great, you know, still unanswered question that people could think about.
This is what just baffles me.
And me.
It's that all this goes on, you know, there's so many geniuses, the smartest people that have ever lived have constantly been racking their brains with that question. There's been so much money just pumped into this question as well, and we still don't know. The best, I don't know if you can say that this is true, I once heard a description of the universe as it being like blowing up a balloon. So just everything is getting bigger. Is that kind of what's going on?
Yeah. That is kind of exactly what's going on. Yeah, or like a bubble expanding. So if you blew a bubble, you know, under the sea, and it would get bigger and bigger as it went up, you can think of the universe like that, yeah.
One last one. This is from me, because I know, Keir, you're really interested in nanotech. How is tiny bits of technology going to help us explore the universe in the future?
Wow, just in so many ways. So most of what we... call nanotechnology right now is really in the materials space. And what I mean by that is you can, if you make a nanostructure in a material, you can tailor the properties of it. So if you want something that's really, really strong and really light, then making these nano size, so 1/1,000,000th of a millimeter sized geometries within it, will allow you to get to making something much stronger or much lighter or much more electrically conductive. So and space is extremely harsh environment. So the satellites that are going around the Earth, as they pass from the sun into the shade, they have a swing of about 400 degrees Celsius. So it goes from plus 200 in the sun to minus 200 in the shade, which is, you know, so it's an incredibly harsh environment. There's tons of radiation out there. So the materials piece and protecting ourselves and our systems from that radiation and the cold and meteorites and everything else is going to be a big way that nanotechnology will help us. But you could also envisage sending out, you know, a fleet of tiny spaceships, essentially, that are sensors, you know, so that you could make actual readings. Because most of what we have to do when we're discovering space right now is, you know, essentially look through a telescope, you know, because everything's so far away. So I quite like the idea of sending out millions of tiny spaceships in every direction.
Oh, and Kit, have you done anything with nanotechnology in space that you can tell us about?
So I designed an interconnect system, a modular interconnect system for a space application that's quite widely used in space, that actually does use nanotechnology. So it uses a polymer that has carbon nanotubes in it, which are crystals of carbon, like diamond is a crystal of carbon, but it's a straw-shaped crystal, right? So it's just a tube of pure carbon. And they're very, very strong. They conduct electricity really well. So you could make this polymer conduct electricity, so you didn't have to be a heavy metal thing. It could be a plastic thing instead. So, yeah, I've used nanotechnology in space.
So there's so many chances for us to affect our exploration in space, and we don't need to go in there. You know, there are so many jobs that we can do to help explore the universe that maybe we can get involved in.
Yeah, do you know, the space industry is growing in the UK. My company, Smiths Group, does a lot of work in space. There is a burgeoning space community, so lots and lots of engineering jobs in space. So, you know, I remember when I first designed the first thing that I designed that went into space, it was just treasured. I wanted to put every single one together, because then it meant that what I had designed and made went into space and I touched it. That was, you know, that just excited me tremendously. And, you know, anybody could do that. Anybody who wants to be an engineer could do that in England. Yeah, no problem.
Brilliant. Well, it's a great way to celebrate World Space Week by reminding us that we don't need to be an actual astronaut to really have a big impact on the way we can explore the universe. Keir, thank you so much for coming in the studio.
It's my pleasure.
Remember, if you've got a question that you want answered by a proper science expert, let me know as a review over on the iTunes podcast store. It's time for today's Dangerous Dan. And for World Space Week, we're learning about planets that go on the run. A rogue planet is a large object of huge mass, and it's lost its planetary system and now it's spinning alone through the universe. So our planetary system is the solar system. And everything that's in it, to qualify as being in the solar system, you have to orbit the sun. But rogue planets, they don't have something to orbit around. They're like a wild, loose cannon. They've been chucked off course. Perhaps they were too unstable, and now they're spinning around everywhere. There's no real way of spotting them either. Now, scientists think that our galaxy, the Milky Way, it may have billions of rogue planets hurling themselves all over the place, just waiting for something to crash into. And it's dangerous, because if one of these rogue planets, they can be huge as well, up to the size of Jupiter. If it heads in our direction, it could smash into us. And we'll find out too late. There's no way of really stopping a rogue planet. How do you stop something the size of Jupiter that's hurtling towards you? Or it could hit into something else that's in the universe and it could spend that spinning out of orbit too. And the problem there is that everything close to us is so finely balanced that one big change, like a planet losing orbit, it could affect the way everything else in the universe is. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We've got a huge guest on this week. He is the first British European Space Agency astronaut, the seventh British person in space as well. Tim Peake, hello, welcome. How are you?
Hello, yeah, I'm very good, thanks.
I'm just going to ask you any question that I've always wanted to ask a spaceman. Is that okay?
Okay, fire away.
If I was 7 years old and I was an astronaut, what would I need to do to make it happen?
Okay, to make it happen, firstly, it's 7 years old. You need to firstly finish school, get some good qualifications. A scientific background would really put you in good stead, studying either science or mathematics background. And then the most important thing that I tell people is, what are you going to do before you become an astronaut? Nobody leaves school and becomes an astronaut. You have to do something first. And that's really important. Find something you love doing, work hard at it, be as good as you can be. Don't be put off by knockbacks on the way, and then you've got the skills to become an astronaut.
Is it as simple as applying for a job as an astronaut in the ESA or NASA or something, or are you headhunted? Are you poached as you would be if you were a spy, maybe?
No, it's absolutely as simple as applying. These opportunities don't come along that often, but when you see them, it was in 2008, I saw an online advert. Do you want to become an astronaut? I thought, yes, I do. I was a test pilot at the time, flying helicopters, and I thought, wow, what an opportunity. So I submitted my application along with 8,413 others and thankfully got through.
And you say that we need to work on skills and abilities and talents before we were to apply for the job. What would you say the key ones that we should be working on to stand us in the perfect stead to become an astronaut?
So to become an astronaut today, the missions are changing. We're looking at deep space exploration now, which is really exciting. Going to the moon, going on to Mars. I spent 6 months in space, which now is very ordinary, but only a few years ago, 6 months was an awfully long time to be in space, and 2 week missions were the norm. But whilst I was up there, I was there with two astronauts who were spending a year in space. I think in a few years' time, we're going to look back and say, 6 months, that's a short mission. We're doing three-year missions to Mars now. So what do you need to do a three-year mission? Well, the kind of skills that will put you in good stead is teamwork, communication, international travel, those kind of things. I mean, we're not going to do any of these missions by ourselves. We're going to do them with our international colleagues. Speaking another language will really help as well. So these are the kind of skills that you can pick up along the way that would stand you in good stead to become an astronaut.
And as you said, you spent 6 months on board ISS. Talk me through an average day. You wake up in the morning, what happens?
Average day, wake up 6 o'clock and go and do your hygiene routine. That's just a quick face wash. There's no shower or anything. It's just hot water in a flannel. Brush your teeth, have some breakfast, cup of tea. And the things I would do would be to check my schedule for the day, and I'd check the orbits for the day, because I wanted to know where are we flying at. We orbit the Earth 16 times a day. So I'd look at each orbit and think, if I was passing over the UK daytime, think, great, that's a good photo opportunity. Or maybe the Himalayas, that's a good one, I'll look out for that. And I'd set my alarm, several alarms throughout the day, so that I knew which photographs I would want to go and take. And then it would be 7 o'clock, we'd start the working day around Robin around the world, literally talking to Houston and Huntsville in America, then over to Munich in Germany, over to Scuba in Japan, then to Moscow in Russia. We'd talk to these ground stations, find out what the day's activities involve, and then get on with our work. 12-hour day, 7 in the morning, 7 at night, mostly science activities, also maintaining the space station. 2 hours of fitness training each day, sometimes some education programs, some PR, etc. And the day just goes by in a blur. You'll probably get about 40 minutes for a bite to eat at lunchtime, and then before you know it, it's 7 o'clock in the evening. You do another round the world, wrap up with all the ground control stations, and get ready for the next day.
Is there no quiet time? Is there no Tim time where you can kind of do stuff that you fancy? I know you're big into your photography. You took your camera up there. How much time do you have to do what you want, to make the most of being in space?
Yeah, so during the day, you can buy yourself some time. If you get some of your jobs done really quickly, then before the next job starts, you might have 5 minutes, 10 minutes. So you've got time to go and take some photographs, maybe have a quick coffee break, tea break, or what have you. But we've always got this backup list of jobs to be done. So even if we get ahead on the timeline, then we go to the backup list and we start working on that. So, you know, we're up there to work hard, and we do work hard. But at the weekends, we do drop the tempo down. Saturday morning, we clean the space station. And then in the afternoon and on Sundays, we do get some time for, you know, calling friends and families and taking photos.
How many people were up in the space station while you were there as well?
I was up there with five others. So we have a normal crew of six on board the space station, is what we try and maintain. But the Soyuz spacecraft takes three people. So you go up as a crew of three and you stay with that crew for 6 months. And then halfway through your mission, three people go down and then you three come and join you.
Now, I can barely go camping with my family for around, I'd say, 3 days before we're at each other's throats. What's it like with five of you being up there for 6 months together? How kind of easy do you have to take it with each other? And what happens if you get a little bit annoyed?
You know, it's really, this question comes up an awful lot, but it's really easy to get on with your crewmates well, because you don't see them for most of the day. Lots of the jobs we do, they're just one person jobs. You're working in a very solitary environment throughout the day. You're working along your timeline, doing your jobs. So it's actually really nice in the evenings to get together, have a meal, and actually chat to each other about what you've been doing. And every Friday, at least, we would come together as a crew of six, usually down in the Russian segment, and we'd all take some of our best food down there, and we would just have a really fun Friday night meal. And so, if anything, it was nice. We looked forward to the evenings when we could actually chat to each other and get to, you know, and get to find out what everyone else has been doing.
What was the toughest everyday task that was surprisingly hard when you were up there?
I think the surprisingly hard thing is the amount of reading you have to do. We do everything by procedure on board the space station, and you have to follow the procedures carefully. You do not want to make a mistake. You know, you're dealing with scientific experiments that people have worked for years on, and your job is to run it accurately. And you might be jumping, you might be doing 20 different procedures each day, and that's an awful lot of reading. And so you've got to read fast, and you've got to read accurately. And that takes a lot of brain power to be able to read fast and accurately and not make mistakes.
Let me just get a few questions in for the Fun Kids listeners. This has been done through a free kids app. It's called Pop Jam. This is from, the names on these people are amazing, by the way. This is from Crazy Cookies 172, who says, what was the most disgusting space food you had to eat?
Most disgusting, it was some peas, mushy peas. They're just bland and no texture to them, not very nice at all. I used to just have to add a lot of Tabasco sauce to make them palatable.
Fiery, fiery mushy peas when you're up there. This is from Blobby Goat, who says, why did you take the Lottie doll with you into space?
So the Lottie doll, it was one of the educational programs. We're looking at encouraging things like astronomy trying to reach out to all sorts of different age groups, different genders as well. So the Lottie doll was one of those programs that we're hoping to encourage people to look at in astronomy.
And then finally, this is from Unicorn Summer 1000, who says, what was the best thing you managed to see from the ISS?
The best thing I managed to see is planet Earth every day. Every time you look at Earth from space, it's different. It changes. It's different, either different seasons, different weather systems, different countries, maybe a nighttime. And it would surprise you. I mean, I'd be brushing my teeth one night. I'd just go and pop down and look out the cupola window, and there'd be the most magnificent aurora. And it was just like this secret that nobody else knew about. And I was witnessing it, and it was incredible. Another time you might see thunderstorms by night, or you might have a wonderful day pass and sneak a volcano that's just erupted, and you think, I wonder if anyone on Earth actually knows that volcano is erupting right now, because it's in the middle of Kamchatka and there's nobody there. There's all these kind of secrets that you get to witness when you look down at Earth from space.
Perfect. Tim, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Right, as it's World Space Week, it seems high time to head to the smartest school outside of the solar system and get a quick lesson from Professor Pulsar.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
This term's assignment is to write your very own universe handbook. You want to cram it full of all the basic things you need to know about space exploration. Yeah, the nuts and bolts of it all. So, let's crack on. Talking of nuts and bolts, Electra, do you think this term you might just remember to tighten your screws to stop various robot limbs from impeding my progress across the room?
Sorry, sir.
Let's start at the beginning. What's the first thing you need to do when you're planning a journey into space?
Make sure you've inflated your lunar lilo.
I thought the holiday might have calmed you lot down. Fat chance. The first thing you need to do is work out where you're going. Have a good look at what's out there. So, how do we observe space?
We use a telescope.
Telescopes aren't the only way to observe space, you know, Alex.
Telescopes are, however, a great place to start. Much better than just using our eyes. Sorry, I'd forgotten you've only got the one blurb. Very nice it is too. So, telescopes, how do they work?
The standard optical telescope works by reflecting or refracting large quantities of light from the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum to a focal point observable through an eyepiece.
Or basically, it scoops up a load of light and squeezes it down to a small point on your eye, where the image appears a lot bigger than it started.
That's what I said!
You're both right, but optical telescopes only work for the visible universe. Stuff our eyes, or eye, sorry blurb, can see.
Well, that's when you need a radio telescope, or an infrared telescope, or even an X-ray telescope.
Cool! Are they like X-ray specs? Can they see through walls?
Behave, Alex. Stats is right. Those sorts of telescopes can pick up waves our eyes can't see to give us even more information about the universe, including images. And infrared telescopes are particularly handy because they also give us information about the temperature of a planet. Have a look at this projection of an infrared image. You'd be right. This planet has been covered in ice for billions of years. What about this one?
Well, it's red and orange in swirls. Is it a hot planet?
You're right. The red-coloured images show us that the temperatures on this planet are much higher.
Much more my style. Get the sunglasses on, crack open the sun cream.
And then you'd burst into flames on this particular planet. Still a bit hotter than you're used to, Alex. A toasty 3,000 degrees. So telescopes can tell us what's out there and how hot or cold they are. But if we're going to visit, we'll need to know how far we have to go. How do we measure distance in space?
Sat-nav?
It'd have to be a blooming big one. No, there are many ways to measure distance in space, but the most common method is called parallax.
Parallax? Isn't that the horrible galactic lurgy that everyone in school got last year?
No, Stats, although it does sound a bit like a nasty disease. Parallax is better shown than explained. If you hold your thumb in front of your face and look at it first with your right and then with your left eye, can you tell me what happens?
Weird. It looks like my thumb moves.
Bingo. It seems to move in relation to the background. How much it moves depends on how far away from your face it is. The distance to a star or planet can be measured by tracking its movement relative to other stars or planets further away. You have to take measurements from two places in our orbit to work it out. And the distance is given in light years.
If it's a distance, why is it measured in years? Shouldn't it be miles? And what's light got to do with it anyway?
The light year is used in astronomy because the universe is huge. The nearest star to your solar system, Alex, is Alpha Centauri, 24 trillion miles. And because the numbers are so big, scientists came up with a simpler unit. A light year is the distance that light travels in space in one year. It's around 6 trillion miles, give or take a bit. So Alpha Centauri is 4 light years away. Much simpler. That's the bell. Next time, we'll be having a think about how we prepare ourselves for deep space exploration.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
It's time for this week's Science in the News. Scientists have found that bombs used in World War II were so large that they weakened the Earth's atmosphere. They found that air raids sent shockwaves felt up to 1,000 kilometres above the Earth, and this released the energy of at least 300 lightning strikes in one go, which has affected the Earth's upper atmosphere ever since. Also, the secret life of the world's largest forest antelope has been revealed. The elusive striped antelope, known as the lowland bongo, it's been caught on camera for the first time. They found that they feed on leaves, bushes and grass, that they're timid and easily frightened, and that male antelopes meet in order to fight others with their horns. And finally, bad news to end. Killer whales, they're in deep trouble because of chemical pollution in the environment. A new study suggests that the long-term life of more than half of the orca groups across the globe is now in question. So groups living around the UK, near Gibraltar, off Spain, by Brazil, California, Japan, they're almost certainly doomed. And that if we don't control our use of chemicals, the threat to more wildlife might be even greater. Right, before we finish today's episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly, let's get some of your space gadget questions answered with Techno Mum. Yeah!
Techno Mum, engineering explorers.
I love coming up with ideas for cool new gadgets. Not surprising, really, when my mum's an engineer. I'm pretty sure she's going to be mega impressed with my latest creation. Jet-propelled roller skates. Just a quick burst of turbo here, and the momentum will carry you along the wheels before
certainly make it quicker to get to school. Not a bad thing when I have to tell you 100 times to hurry up.
You'd be chasing me up the road in these.
That would make a nice change. You know, there are engineers out there working on other cool new ways to get things up in the air.
What kind of engineers?
Aeronautical and aerospace engineers.
Aeronautical and aerospace engineers? I guess what they have in common is the air.
That's right. Both involve working with aircraft. Things which you make that can fly.
Like an enormous jumbo jet or even a rocket.
Cool. It could be. But they also create smaller things, like satellites the size of this table or drones that fit in one hand. There's lots of exciting new technology and it comes in all shapes and sizes.
So, what's the difference between aeronautical and aerospace engineers?
Aeronautical engineers work with aircraft that operate inside the Earth's atmosphere, things like planes, helicopters and drones. Aerospace engineers work on things which operate...
Let me guess, in space?
You're very bright, aren't you? Wonder where you get it from?
I'd love a job working on planes, or better still, rockets.
Well, there's no reason why you can't. Aerospace engineers are busier than ever. Check out this video. Aerospace jobs have been created because of our need for satellites. We're using more and more of them all the time, not just for watching the telly, but to observe the Earth and the atmosphere. Over the next 10 years, it's expected that there will be over 3,000 launches. That's a lot of launches, and they don't just magically appear up in orbit. Something has to carry them into orbit. This aerospace engineer is working on a space plane, which will fly both to outside of our atmosphere. It could carry satellites into orbit or take supplies to the International Space Station, which is a satellite itself.
So a space plane is kind of like a delivery van?
A very fast, very high-tech van, yes. This prototype plane has taken some test flights, and the engineer is looking at the results on a computer. It looks like part of the fuselage has been damaged. She's investigating why that might be. Because things like space planes are extremely complex, engineers often work in teams, and being good at detail is critical because safety is so important. Now, while some engineers will be coming up with creative solutions...
Like my jet-propelled roller skates?
Perhaps. Well, other engineers will be more focused on checking that the plans have been correctly followed, helping to figure out why things might not have gone as planned.
Cool job.
There are loads of cool jobs for engineers. Almost as many jobs as there are inventions.
Speaking of inventions, I think I can feel another idea coming on. Levitating trousers?
Engineering Explorers, created with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology to celebrate the Year of Engineering. Find out more at funkislive.com/technomum.
Right, that is it for this week's World Space Week edition of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. You can find out loads more about World Space Week on our website, which is funkidslive.com. Also, remember, if you've got a science question that you want answered by a proper expert, something about the world and the universe around you that's just niggling in your brain, something you can't quite figure out, let me know and I will ask an expert for you. The best place to do that is to leave your question as a review on the iTunes podcast store, and you'll get a shout out in the next few weeks as well. Also, iTunes is one of the best places that you can listen to all our brilliant Fun Kids Science series. You can also subscribe to it on Google Podcasts. You can find them on the free Fun Kids app, and you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, it's a children's radio station that you can hear all over the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.